I grew up in a home that could very easily be known as a zoo. We had so many animals at our place. We had cats, we had dogs, we had birds, we had rabbits, we had ferrets, we had lizards, we had snakes, we had goats, we had deers, we even had a kangaroo. That's right, we had a kangaroo for 13 years, all on a quarter-acre block in Wilberforce. I found out later why we had so many animals. It happened because my mum wanted a big family with lots of kids, and my dad wanted a family of one kid. He settled for two, and then every time my mum got clucky, he would buy her another pet. And so hence, we had a vast menagerie of all different pets in our home. I understand what it's like to love pets. I understand what it's like to desire pets. But I also know how much hard work it takes to get a pet to the point that they're fun. It's really cute when you go to a place when there are lots of pets that are well-behaved because you can play with them and they're nice and lovely. But behind closed doors, it's a nightmare. Hey, who's a real pet lover here? Don't be shameful. It's okay. We can pray for you afterwards. There's a few of you here. Yep. There's something about pets that just takes a lot of work. So when I left home, I thought, no. I'm not going to have any pets. It's too much hard work. I'm at uni. I've got too much to do. I'm going to stay right away. But over time, I thought, you know what? I could really do with something. And so I bought myself a fish tank and three goldfish. I thought, you know, I reckon I can handle three goldfish. So I bought myself a little setup, and I had Tom, Dick, and Harry. And they were my three goldfish, and they were lovely. But they didn't last very long. I managed to kill Tom, Dick, and Harry within about the first month. And so I thought, I'll give it another crack. And I bought Larry, Curly, and Moe to replace Tom, Dick, and Harry. And Larry, Curly, and Moe didn't last very long either. It turns out, so you might already know this, it turns out what looks like a lovely, clean fishbowl isn't always a lovely, clean fishbowl. You see, what they tell me is if you put your finger in the water and start swirling up the fishbowl, all the yuck and muck and food and everything else that's in the fishbowl rises, and you go, that's why you need to change the water in a fishbowl regularly. It turns out I'm very glad that I didn't get anything bigger, because I can't keep goldfish alive, because apparently I'm no good at cleaning the tank regularly enough. There's something about swirling the waters that makes the muck rise. Friends, we are in the middle now, or towards the end, of our series in Ephesians that we've called our Jesus-shaped community. And in the first three chapters, we got a real cosmic perspective on what church is really like. We got the view that church is God's handiwork, that church is actually used to display the glory of God to the powers and authorities in the heavenly realm. You and I, if we are part of this church, are an impressive group of people. In fact, anyone who trusts in Jesus, we read in Ephesians 1 that we have been blessed with every spiritual blessing in Christ. We have been brought from death into life. We have been made alive. And we've been given, within all of our diversity, a unity that no one can take from us. The church is an impressive, impressive group of people. And often we get to the point where we look around at each other and go, God must have been thinking about some other church, because I know the people in this church, and sometimes we don't seem all that impressive. Often that's me holding a mirror up to myself. And so in the next three chapters, what Paul is going to do is he's going to take an inside perspective on the church. What is the church like from the inside out? What does it mean to be a part of God's Jesus-shaped community? What does it look like to be the church? And at that point, he picks up this metaphor of walking. Hey, we've got slides. He picks up this metaphor of walking. The Christian walk is not a sprint. The Christian life is not something that you do your dash for 11 seconds or 46 seconds, wherever long it takes you to run 100 meters. No, no, no. The Christian walk is a long-distance event. The Christian walk is something that you do slowly. Growth is something that takes time. And so this idea of walking, the Christian walk, you might have heard someone ask, or you might have overheard someone else ask, how is your walk with Jesus going? Or how is your walk going? Are you looking more and more like Jesus? And so it's not surprising that in chapter 4, he begins this second half of Ephesians by looking at just that. 4 and verse 1, I therefore, a prisoner for the Lord, urge you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which you have been called. We are called to walk in a way that reflects the grand calling that we have as children of Jesus. Chapter 4 is divided neatly into two parts, and the second part is very similar, also introduced by this idea of walking. Now this I say and testify in the Lord, that you must no longer walk as the Gentiles do. In order to fulfill our calling as sons and daughters of the risen of the Lord and King, we are to not walk as outsiders do. In fact, we're to not walk as we used to walk. He said this to a Gentile audience. You need to change. And change is scary. Change is painful. But change he calls us to do. And so we reach now chapter 5. And in three different sections, once again, Paul is going to bring forward this idea of walking. We're to walk this way. We're to walk this way. We're to walk this way. And as we look at today, and as we look at the next 2 weeks in this series in particular, we're going to cover a whole bunch of areas of the Christian walk. We're going to cover what does it look like in our relationship to the world that we live in? What does it look like in marriage relationship between a husband and a wife? What does it look like between children and parents, parents and children? What does it look like in our workplaces? We're going to go through all of these different areas of life. And Paul and God are going to be stirring the waters of our soul. You might think, you know, my life is pretty good. I live a good, godly, obedient life. And in the abstract, that's really easy to say. As you come along and sit in church, I don't know about you, but I can fake looking godly for an hour and 15 minutes on a Sunday pretty well. I can fake that my life is all together and wonderful, and I don't need to change a bit. But as we walk through the different areas of life on a Tuesday and a Friday night and a Saturday morning, what's going to happen as we encounter these spheres of life? God's going to slowly stir the fish tank of your soul, and it's going to look not quite as clean as you thought. One or two or all of these areas, you're going to start to feel that tug of your conscience that maybe I do need to change after all. Maybe there is some parts of all of these areas that God's calling me to change. Because as I see the perfect path that he has to set before me, as I consider my own walk, maybe I'm not as clean as I first thought. And as we get to those uncomfortable moments, as we get to those stages where our conscience is really pricking us heavily and going, this is you he's talking about. You're no good in this area. You're going to need to change. I don't know if you're going to be able to change. As that happens, it's really important to remember verses 1 and 2. So take a look with me, Ephesians 5, verses 1 and 2. These are going to be key. Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children. And walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. Christianity is unique amongst every religion in the world in saying, come to me broken. Come to me dirty. Come to me unclean. come to me knowing that you are not perfect. And I will welcome you into my family and I will change you from the inside out. Christianity says you are loved before you are called to change. Let me say that again. This is brilliant news, friends. Christianity says you are a dearly beloved child of God. You have been welcomed into his home. You've been welcomed into his family. You have been known and loved before the foundation of the world in Christ. And it's therefore as a dearly beloved child that you are then called to act out change. And so what that means is that's wonderful news. None of us have it all together. The most godly person, as you look around this room, they've got secrets. They've got a past. They've got areas of their life that aren't clean. We all do. But as God's family, as dearly beloved people, we strive together in our walk to look more and more like Jesus as he himself works inside us. Sometimes that's going to be painful. One of the joys of my job is a flexibility of time, and there are lots of times I get to go and pick up my kids from school. I get to pick them up and bring them home, and I often need to park on the other side of the road to our house. I open the door and I watch my kids dart across the road to get inside and have whatever snack they're going to have afterwards. And there was one day I can remember as clear as day that I opened the door and Michaela heads across the road and I can see a car coming. So I have to yell at her. I say, Michaela, stop. And I reached out and I sort of grabbed her by the shoulder. And she turned back and gave me the filthiest, the most hurtful, kind of shocked, kind of sad look all in one going, Dad, you screamed at me. And she burst down into tears. It was painful for her to be told to stop. But as a loving father, when I see danger for my children, I'm going to do whatever I can to get them to stop. And that's exactly what God is doing in these next sections. God, who knows what is good for us, who knows when danger is lurking around the bend, is going to scream at you. He's going to reach out and he's going to say, you're going the wrong way. Please come back to safety. The first way he's going to do that is in calling us from sexual immorality to thankfulness. And this is one of those areas that, as a preacher, I feel acutely aware that this is an unpopular message in the world today. Take a look with me as we pick it up in verse 3. Ephesians 5 and verse 3. But sexual immorality and all impurity or covetousness must not even be named among you, as is proper among the saints. Let therefore no filthiness, nor foolish talk, nor crude joking, which are out of place. You might, if you've been a Christian for a while and you're more familiar with the older versions of the Bible, you might be familiar with the phrase fornication. It was the word that was originally translated sexual immorality. Fornication must not even be named among you. Until the people of society kind of realized, we don't know what fornication means anymore. And so they changed it to sexual immorality. And now no one knows what sexual immorality means anymore. And it's really, really tricky. But while it might be hard to work out what does this mean, the concept is as simple as day. Sexual activity outside of a committed marriage relationship between a husband and a wife is sexual immorality. Any sexual behavior outside of a lifelong commitment in marriage between a husband and a wife. God says, this behavior and all impurities or that covetousness, that desire for more, is not right for a Christian. It is not healthy, it is not safe, and so we need to change. Now, friends, in the world we live in today, that is viewed as outdated, archaic. It's even viewed as dangerous and inappropriate. It's the sort of thing that we're not even allowed to teach in schools anymore. Why would God give such a commandment? Friends, because he loves his children. From the very beginning of the Bible, sex is not something that is wrong. Sex is not something that is evil. Sex is not something to be escaped from. It's not something that should never be spoken about. No, no, no. God designed sex. Sex is a good and a wonderful gift. I've heard sex described a little bit like fire. Within a fireplace, in a home, fire gives warmth to the house. It brings comfort and joy. And to be able to sit back on a comfortable sofa in a dressing gown and, you know, feet up and a nice hot chocolate sitting by the fireplace, it is a wonderful place to be. But outside of a fireplace, within a home, fire is really dangerous. And it can do enormous damage. God says sex is a wonderful gift. But the place that he has designed sex to work best is between a husband and a wife. In a relationship of faithfulness, where one is able to continually give and give, and the other is able to continually give and give, knowing that that is a committed relationship for life. You might have heard some of the recent controversy over a particular archbishop's speech at an event that happened within the Anglican Church a little while ago. The archbishop got up and said, funnily enough, after 2,000 years of believing the same thing, we believe the same thing about marriage. We believe that marriage is for sexual activity, and sexual activity is made for marriage, and we think that Christian churches should maintain that view of thinking. And the world has reacted so angrily against that. How dare you call these other forms of love? But friends, all of us are broken in terms of this kind of behavior. This passage is not the sort of thing where you look at other people and go, you know what, they're sexually broken. This group of people, they need to change. That group of people, they need to change. Friends, this passage confronts each and every one of us. Because sexual immorality is an enormous, enormous area. It means that that deep emotional relationship you've clung to with someone at work that is stretching those boundaries is out of place. It means those activities that you're involved in with your fiance or boyfriend or girlfriend are out of place. It means the things that you look at on your computer screen or your phone when you think that nobody's watching are wrong and hurting and causing you and others great damage. I heard a stat this week that the pornography industry brings in more money than the NBA, the NHL, and the NFL in America put together. It is a huge industry, destroying lives, tearing families apart. And so he goes on to say that even talk about these kind of things are inappropriate. Those crude jokes that are said over the water cooler at work, they're not to be said. Those witty double entendres where you say something that's both clever and crude at the same time are out of place. Friends, we are called to flee from sexual immorality. Verses 5 and 6 go on to say why. Verse 5, for you may be sure of this, that everyone who is sexually immoral or impure or who is covetous, he goes on to say that is an idolater. Paul's going on to say here that if you have that continual lust for more, if you're not satisfied with whatever stage of life you're at now, but you're not satisfied with the marriage that you've got, or you're not satisfied in your singleness and you just need to lust after more, that actually you have a God there, that God is either in that relationship that's inappropriate or it's in your desires to feel pleasure more and more, that that has become your God and replaced the true and living God. But these activities have no inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. This is not saying that anyone who has committed a sexual sin will not go to heaven, but it is saying that if you have a style of behavior, if you walk in a certain way, unrepentant in that way, with no desire to change and an unwillingness to see it as wrong, then you have to ask yourself, are you truly following Jesus? Has the Spirit come upon you? Or are you your own God? Same thing said in verse 6, let no one deceive you with empty words. Because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. So those church leaders who are saying these rules are archaic and they need to change, we need to update the Bible, we need to become more relevant. Don't listen to those empty words. There's no truth in them. There's no power in their message. There's no salvation for those who believe them. For the wrath of God comes against this kind of behavior, this kind of lifestyle in its unrepentant form. Friends, we are to flee from sexual immorality. What's the alternative? It's an unusual one. It's hidden there at the end of verse 4. Let there be no filthiness, nor foolish talk, nor crude joking, which is out of place, but instead, let there be thanksgiving. If I was told, you know, ask the question, what's the opposite of sexual immorality? I would have said something like self-control, discipline, fleeing. What does Paul say the opposite of sexual immorality is? It's thankfulness. That seemed a little bit odd to me. But the more I think about it, the more it makes absolute sense. Because what is sexual immorality other than a constant desire for what we don't have? Sexual immorality is saying, this person, this thing, this feeling that is not mine, I want to take it. This person that I'm not married to, I want that. It's desiring what God has not yet given us. And what is thankfulness? Why, it's saying it's being grateful for what we do have. It's being thankful for all the things we have been given. And so God calls you to be thankful within your marriage. No matter how much you might feel like you're not being fulfilled in a certain way, you have been given this partner. They have been given to you. You should be thankful. If you're single, And you're like, I just wish I had someone. I feel this need to be sexually fulfilled. Then God calls you to be thankful for your singleness. Be thankful for what is elsewhere described as the gift of singleness. For the ability to do so many things that married people simply can't do. We are called to flee from sexual immorality. Walk from sexual immorality into thankfulness. How do we go at that? My guess is the moment we stop whinging and complaining about what we don't have and start being thankful for what we do have, fleeing sexual immorality will get easier and easier. That's the first area that God might be stirring the waters of your soul and saying, maybe you're not as clean as you thought. I'm calling you to change. The second area that we're called is in the relationship we have with the world. Take a look with me as we're called from darkness to light. Therefore, do not become partners with them. Verse 7, for at one time you were darkness, but now you are light in the world. Walk as children of light. Skip down to verse 11. Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead expose them. For it is shameful even to speak of the things that they do in secret. But when anything is exposed by the light, it becomes visible. For anything that becomes visible is light. Therefore it says, awake, O sleeper, and arise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. What a beautiful picture. That we who lived a certain way were darkness. but we have not only seen a great light. What does it say? We have become light in the Lord. As you walk with Jesus, you shine light into the darkness. Now it says here we are to have no partnership. We are to take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness. It would have been very easy for the people in Ephesus to say, how are we supposed to live like that? You see, Ephesus was a crude, dark city. They had the temple of Artemis. She was the goddess of fertility. And what happened in those temples? Well, Paul knew what happened in those temples. The Ephesians knew what happened in those temples. And Paul said, it's best for all of us if we don't even speak it. The shameful things that went on and the degrading of their bodies that went on within these temples. And so it would be easy for the people of Ephesus to say, what are we meant to do? Are we meant to do what the monks once did and retreat off into some hidden part of the world and build nests on big giant poles to just escape it all? No. We're called to live in the world and expose the darkness with our light. Jesus was a perfect illustration of this. Because who did Jesus hang around with? Simply people who agreed with him? No. Jesus spent all his time around tax collectors and sinners and prostitutes and broken people. He didn't become like them. Everyone who he was around, they knew his position on things. They knew he'd lived a perfect life. They knew he didn't condone their activities. But Jesus hung out with all sorts of people. That his good life, that his light might shine into their lives and that they might see that what they were doing was darkness. And not only that, that they might be attracted to the light. That they might see our good deeds and praise our Father in heaven, as it is put elsewhere. Friends, how do we live in Sydney in this day and age? In a city that's full of promiscuity, that's full of the freedoms that come from the sexual revolution. Well, we're to befriend everybody. We're to love everybody. But we're not to live like them. We're to live in the light as dearly beloved children of God. I heard a great illustration of this during the week. In America, has anyone heard of Chick-fil-A? Is it good? Yeah, I've heard they're like the chicken place to go in America, in a whole bunch of areas. And the CEO of Chick-fil-A is a godly Christian man. He was asked in a radio interview once what his view on marriage was. And as a Christian, not surprisingly, he affirmed the sexual idea of Christianity that we've held for 2,000 years. The very next day, there was a pride organization that was a part of a whole bunch of universities throughout America, and their president said, we tell all our members to boycott Chick-fil-A. Never use their restaurants again. A couple of days later, the CEO of Chick-fil-A gave the president of this pride organization a call. Not to tell him to call off the boycott, not to do anything else, but to start a conversation. He actually invited him around to his home and said, hey, I'd love to share a meal with you. And what developed over time was a really beautiful friendship. A wonderful friendship where two people who thoroughly disagreed with each other grew in hospitality together, grew in friendship with one another. They got to know each other really, really well. The president of the Pride organization, he didn't change his behavior. He didn't become a Christian. But his heart was warmed by this particular friendship. And they got along really, really well. In fact, he wrote a newspaper article that he entitled, Coming Out as a Friend of Dan Cathy. Coming Out as a Friend of the CEO of the organization that so differed in its opinions of the world. And he went on to say of Dan, he expanded his world without abandoning it. He expanded his world to share meals with people who disagreed with him. To live life with those who were in very different stages and had very different views than he did. He said, Dan called that the biblical definition of hospitality, but I call it human decency. This is a beautiful friendship of somebody who took this message to heart, that we are not to escape this world, but we're called as light to go out into the world and to live differently. We're called to expose darkness by our actions of light. And in doing so, we'll find that some will themselves become light. And so we see in verse 14 what was either an indirect reference to Isaiah 29 and Isaiah 60, or an early Christian hymn associated with the ceremony of baptism. Awake, O sleeper, and arise from the dead, and Christ will shine on you. Friends, how are we called to live in this day and age as God's Jesus-shaped community? We're called to look different. We're called to change. We're called to live a life where we flee from sexual immorality and we cling to thankfulness. But we're called to do that in the presence of a watching world. We're called to do that whilst at the same time making friends with people who are so different to us, so that they might see the light of Christ in us and through our actions. And so when they start asking questions, we can tell them about Jesus. The third area we're called is to go from unwise to wise, but I've run out of time. So will you pray with me?